Hello and welcome to Cruise Club. We've got the need to podcast. This is episode 5, Risky Business from 1983. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And before we get to our two guests for this episode, important to note, this is our podcast album art. Disgustingly stole it from Risky Business.
Oh, yeah, so the sunglasses.
We are there already, the Wayfarers. And then number 2, I had a number 2, and I don't know what it was.
All right.
I never saw this movie before, though, and I love it.
Oh, well, welcome
to the club. It's a real, real weird movie, and I can't wait to talk about it. With us, first, you may know him. So if you listen to the Tom Tom Club in its entirety, the Tom Hanks and the Tom Cruise side, both of those sides, you already know our first guest from both episodes of Bosom Buddies. But if you only listen to Tom Cruise, the Cruise Club podcast, you may not know him. He is the host of the High School Slumber Party podcast here on the Cage Club Podcast Network. We have Brian Rodriguez. Hello, Brian.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm not going to use my TV expertise today, but ready to have my high school expertise. Like,
it's one or the other.
I don't know, Brian. What TV show was Bronson Pinchot once in?
Perfect Strangers.
See, there you go. Came in handy.
And also, here's a pop quiz for you. Which TV show was Perfect Strangers referenced in the last 5 years? Like, sort of like as a joke, but then became a kind of a serious through line?
I don't know. Tell me.
Can I answer?
You can.
The Leftovers.
You got it.
Mark Lynn Baker.
There is a throwaway joke in the one of the first episodes that all four of the main people in Perfect Strangers get raptured or get taken or whatever the, you know, go away, disappear, and then it sort of evolves into the thing that, like, becomes the basis of an entire episode, which is incredible. Like, it's so good. That whole show is so good, and, you know, that's a whole other podcast. Also with us today, he's been on our Too Fast, Too Forever podcast. He's been on Cage Club with us. He is the creator, the mastermind behind Numlock News, the only newsletter. Actually, that's a lie. I get my boss's newsletter, too. The only newsletter I subscribe to who comes from someone who does not pay me my salary. We have Mr. Walt Hickey. Hello, Walt.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on. You guys know how much I love being here. I really, really enjoy the podcast, and I was super thrilled to come back.
Thank you for being here. We are thrilled to have both of you here to talk about Risky Business, a movie that I said I have never seen before. Hmm. And Mike, last week, yep, when we guessed, or 2 weeks ago, whenever we guessed, I guess it was last week.
Yeah, it was on
the Mazes and Monsters.
Yeah, you and Chris Podcast guessed what this was about.
And I kind of got it right, but there is way more than I said.
You got a little bit. You're on the right track.
My guess was that the parents go away, check, and that he throws a party, check, and that was the entire plot of the movie.
Well, no, you also said that he would get involved with an older woman.
Well, that's because Larson told me that.
Put that in your head. Yeah.
Yes, which is kind of true. Oh, here's the other thing I wanted to say before we get any further. I don't know if any of you listen to, or I guess watch when I was on HBO, the Ricky Gervais podcast?
The animated one? Yeah.
Yes.
No, I didn't even know it existed. I'm kind of happy about that.
Ricky Gervais was, I guess, the first, like, celebrity podcaster. Like, he was the first person who was already famous and then, you know, had a very successful podcast. Now, I don't think it's worth, you know, listening to because Ricky Gervais is, we sort of, I think, have a collective Ricky Gervais fatigue.
I think the show with Carl going around the world might be worth
it. In Idiot Abroad, yes. So I'm glad you bring up Carl, because the one thing that I knew, quote-unquote knew, about Rebecca De Mornay came from that show. Carl Pilkington, I think, is trying to describe a movie, or he's trying to come up with a movie, and it stars Rebecca De Mornay and Clive Owen, whom he calls Clive Warren. And he basically describes what becomes a Black Mirror episode. So there's, like, all these things. Like, if you search Carl Pilkington, Rebecca De Mornay on Google, it's just like Carl Pilkington predicted 3 episodes of Black Mirror a decade before they aired. So that's, you know, that's worth looking into because Carl is wonderful. That show is basically just Ricky and Stephen Merchant poking at Carl Pilkington until he says something stupid. Like, that was my entire history with Rebecca De Mornay, and I knew that she was, like, a person.
Hand That Rocks the Cradle, nothing?
I've never seen... I was 0 of 40 movies of her on Letterboxd.
Speaking of 40, I keep forgetting that I'll be 40 this year, and yes, you will not, and that I just grew up with this whole other set of movies and that I've seen.
I need you to remember, as we learned or we discussed in a Cage Club Revisited recently, that I am in the before sunset period of my life, and you are in the before midnight period of your life.
Correct.
So it's a very different...
Good call.
When did life periods turn into Twilight books? I don't understand. What the hell?
No. They're Linklater movies.
Oh, okay.
Richard Linklater, Julie Delpy, Ethan Hawke. Come on, man.
I don't know. The only movies from that director that I watch.
The ones where the girls stay the same age.
Yep.
Yeah, I never knew Rebecca De Mornay. All I know now about her is that she's beautiful, that she's good in this movie. This was supposed to be, Mike, if you remember, the Diane Lane part when Tom Cruise tried to recruit her while they were filming The Outsiders, and her dad said, "You're not playing a 20-year-old hooker. No way." That's probably good, because within a minute of Rebecca De Mornay showing up, she is fully nude. And I was like, oh, huh. All right. I guess that's where we're going here. But, you know, I guess before we go further, Walt, had you seen this movie before? I'm assuming so, but I don't want to assume too much.
Yeah, I had actually not seen this before. I mean, I feel like everybody who has just kind of inhabited the like vague cultural conversation has absolutely seen the Tom Cruise like slide in, and then that's the risky business bit, right? But I had actually never seen the movie proper. I had kind of gone into it with absolutely no expectations. I didn't really know what was going to happen. And I was like really, really pleasantly surprised. I kind of, I'm happy you guys are doing this series, because I definitely consider myself a person who, if not likes, at least is fascinated by Tom Cruise. And I think that this was such a good look at what he's about and what was so interesting about him early on in his career, and then eventually what became kind of the crux of the Cruise, you know? So I really enjoyed it. I did not know what to expect, and I thought it was great. And so I would say in general, I liked it. Yeah.
I'm glad that you enjoyed it. Now, Brian, had you seen it before?
I don't know. Like, it was one of these movies where if I'd seen it, it was just on TV and I wasn't really paying attention. And I purposely avoided it when I started my podcast.
I'm really surprised in this day and age, you like basically all of you guys haven't had this movie spoiled all the way through. Like, didn't know what it was all about. Like,
well, I knew what it was about. I just, you know, never really like focused or concentrated on it. And if I saw it, it was probably like in high school or college.
Yeah, that's when I saw it, in high school on cable late at night. You know, like, the way I guess, you know, it's intended to first be discovered.
I mean, it's a movie that I bought on Blu-ray. I was looking like 6 years ago for $5, and I unsealed it tonight. So that it's been a long time coming, I guess, for this. I knew it was sort of like a landmark, kind of not historic movie.
Well,
I guess
it's a big Brian's Cruise term, performance,
iconic.
You know,
iconic. Like, Mike, I can't believe we were talking with Larson, I think, or maybe it was the last episode, the Mazes and Monsters episode. They're already all blurring together. We were talking about dancing scene. It was with Larson, because Losing It, and we're talking about the dancing scene. And you said you couldn't remember a dancing scene in here, and I was like, how is that? Because like even when you watch it here, it's like it is. Like what we're saying, this is the one scene everybody knows.
I was semi-joking during that episode. I was
okay.
I wasn't being entirely serious, though. I was just trying to get it out there. But no, I mean, like, that's funny you bring that up, though, because watching it this time, I'm wondering, what's the more iconic song? The old-time rock and roll or Something in the Air Tonight?
Old-time
rock
and roll.
Scene is
old-time
like,
rock and roll, definitely.
Well, and I don't know anymore.
And the Air Tonight has too much of a Miami Vice connotation.
But this was before Miami Vice.
Yeah, the soundtrack is great. It's super duper 80s. It absolutely sets a mood. It's very entangled with its place and time. And I was like really, really kind of blown away by it.
Yeah, Hungry Heart. Yeah, right? There's like a Springsteen song in here.
Dance music, sex romance. You got the Talking Heads, Swamp. You got a lot. Like, this is a great soundtrack.
Absolutely.
You've got Tangerine Dream doing the score. Like, the music in this is on point.
Oh, I know.
We're definitely going to come back to that. In the awards. But, you know, Brian, this apparently, I looked it up, this preceded the Miami Vice episode by a year or more.
Doesn't matter. The Miami Vice episode that's the pilot. It's the most iconic, one of the most iconic pilots, certainly for a drama. One of the first TV shows to ever feature a song in it, like a pop song in it. You know, Phil Collins later guest starred on the show. To me, it's definitely first Miami Vice before this film. Especially when you have another song in this that really, like, everyone remembers from the movie.
So there is a lot of wild trivia on IMDb about this movie, but one of the things said that whole dance scene to old-time rock and roll was just improvised. It was just, quote, dance to rock music was all that was in the script. So that was all him just
That helps when you're the writer-director, when you can just write that and then figure it out later.
So there is wild... When do we want to get into the insane quotes that people have said about Tom Cruise in this movie? Do we want to do that now or later or throughout?
You mean like behind the scenes stuff that said during the filming of this?
Yes.
No, let's hear him now. Let's get it out of the way. I feel like so much of what Tom Cruise's movies are about is Tom Cruise and the trivia behind it. So I would actually love to hear some details on behind him.
Most of this is bad. I'll just say that up front. Most of this is bad. So a lot of this comes from Bronson Pinchot. So there was a 2009 interview with the AV Club where he said a bunch of things. Apparently he would just Tom Cruise. And then I also feel like, and this is coming from nothing, that I don't know if I believe Bronson Pinchot.
Yeah, you know where this is coming from for me? When we just did all those Amy Heckerling movies for Cinemakers and found out that he was kind of a jerk-off boyfriend to her for a lot of years and stuff. And
yeah.
Had, like, a real diva attitude and all that shit. Like, I mean, I like his work, but I'm not so sure about his word right now.
Two things that Bronson Pinchot said. Number one, Tom Cruise would only address his fellow actors by their characters' names, which is feel like we get that sense that he's like a Daniel Day-Lewis.
More like Sean Penn in during those days, but
I got Sean Penn for me too, so we're gonna get to there eventually too.
Yikes.
But Bronson Pinchot also said, this is super weird, and I guess kind of it ties into another thing. This is unfortunate if true. Bronson Pinchot said, quote, he was tense and made constant unrelated homophobic comments. You want some ice cream in case there are no gay people there? I mean, his lingo was larded with the most. There was no basis for it. It was like, it's a nice day. I'm glad there are no gay people standing here. Very, very strange. In the same interview, Pinchot said working with Cruise, quote, weird, and called Cruise, quote, the biggest bore on the face of the earth. So that is weird. Unfortunate if true, for sure. There's also another thing that ties into it. So Curtis Armstrong, who plays Miles?
Booger himself.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Better off dead. Better off dead, don't forget.
Yeah.
So in his autobiography, Revenge of the Nerd, he recalled working Tom Cruise. He said, Tom self-identified as a born-again Christian, which this seems to counteract everything that we've seen in this part of, up to his career. Mike, like, it seems like he's just party all the time.
That's crazy. Who would ever believe that Tom Cruise would fall in with a peculiar religion and that stories would be told about it?
I know. It's so weird. The views of Walt Hickey do not reflect Cruise Club. Please do not come after us. And the rumor was he had actually considered shepherding souls for a living. I could believe it.
Oh, like Pardew.
A holy man. Away from the set, initially, Tom made straight arrows look like corkscrews. I would ask him at the end of the day if he wanted to join us for at the bar for a drink. No, I recall him saying. Got an early call tomorrow. Got to work out still, study my lines, and then I'd like to read the Bible a bit before bed. I laughed. He didn't. But then, and this is where it gets interesting, but then, returning late one night, I found three or four young girls, late teens, I suspect, Cruise was about 20 at the time of this movie, lined up in the hall outside of Tom's room. I remember thinking, quote, Tom's going to be really upset if these hot girls interfere with his Bible reading. So I asked them with all the stern gravitas of my 28 years, by the way, he was 28 playing a high schooler.
Bronson? Oh, I'm sorry, Curtis Armstrong. Okay.
If there was something I could do to help them, they just stared at me, and at that moment, Tom's door opened, and another girl came out, adjusting her hair and taking off down the hall, while the first girl in line slipped into Tom's room. There was a young man who knew something about time management and understood how to successfully juggle Bible study and blowjobs. I went to bed alone that night thinking it served me right for not being religious. And then, again, Curtis Armstrong said, Tom's an interesting character. Can't really make him out. He would appear to be on the brink of a great career. He wrote this in his journal that he kept, or diary that he kept while making the movie. But when it comes to doing things with him socially or professionally, he's not terribly reliable. Always late, very casual with other people's time. But in spite of it all, it's difficult not to like him. Though it's early days, the rehearsing I've done with him has gone smoothly. No arrogance or selfishness there yet, we'll see. Mm-hmm. I think one thing that we're running into, Mike, on this podcast, both in the crazy wild stories and also the, like, hey, he's kind of a little bit of a weirdo, is that once he becomes the most famous Scientologist in the world, I feel like we're going to be getting a lot of, like, after-the-fact, quote-unquote, trivia. You know what I mean? Where people are like, oh, I saw this coming, or I've got a story about him.
Yeah.
And Cage and Keanu's kind of mercurial, and Charlize is relatively, I think, you know, wild childhood, but, you know, other than that, sort of uneventful life, which is fine. But I feel like he's the first actor that we're covering, I guess Shia too, in a way, but, you know, it's the first actor we're covering that is, that there is this public perception of him. And I think that it's going to be interesting to sort of see the trivia evolve with that in mind. They're trying to separate the art from the artist in a way, but
yeah,
that there's a lot of stories out there about him that people are like, you know, they want to sort of get a shot in at him or say that they were there or that they know something about him or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, no, without a doubt, like, yeah, I mean, just due to his incredible success and, like, popularity, yeah, absolutely, I think, like, it's unavoidable. You know, he's controversial. What can you do, you know? Like, it's just, he's massive, and, yeah, every sort of part of his life people want to know about and stuff, and so when people started digging, it got kind of, they did kind of find some weird stuff, but, like, yeah, I agree with you say about actors too. Looking back, maybe, you know, they just want to a little bit of recognition for themselves, and they get some of that by trying to bring up stories about people, whatever, what have you. But it'll be interesting going forward, because there's also a lot of public stuff that happens, like, during press and stuff, you know, a lot of, like, couch jumping and stuff like that. So, you know, when we get there, we'll get there. But it's definitely, you're right, something we have not really delved into or dealt with our previous actors and actresses. So,
yeah, for sure.
And I don't know if you're going to deal with it too much with Tom Hanks on the other side of this podcast. So,
I don't think so.
No, so far all the behind the scenes stuff is like, oh, we liked him so much we didn't even want to kill off his character.
Yeah. That's wow. True. The one thing I have heard about Tom Cruise, and I think I've said this before, is that for all intents and purposes, he seems like, people have said he's a genuinely nice guy on set, that he remembers everyone's name, so I don't know, there's a lot more about him, I think, out in the world. Like, people look at Nick Cage and like, oh, he's a terrible actor, he buys weird things, but, like, that's not, like, that's just, like, the very tip of the iceberg and not really true, or not, you know, there's an explanation, there's a reason for it all. You know, we're just going to see, like, we are 5 episodes into, like, 45 or so we've got a lot more Tom Cruise trivia to go, but just the things I saw. And the only thing I want to read quickly before I stop talking for a while, the main character was originally cast, Brian Backer was cast as Joel. Joel Goodson.
The very good
but son. Replaced by Tom Cruise after Cruise audition and impressed the filmmakers. But, So here's the interesting thing. The list of names who auditioned for this role are basically, Mike, like, our greatest hits. Okay, are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
John Cusack. Michael J. Fox. Alex B. Keaton.
Nice, okay.
Sean Penn.
Uh-huh.
Tom Hanks.
Hey.
And Nicolas Cage.
Wow.
That's crazy. You know, I could have sworn I saw in one of the few high school shots, Brian, that actually takes place, this kid comes walking down the stairs, and I was like, is that Cage? And I rewound, and it wasn't. But I mean, that's crazy.
So there is one thing I want to put in here. You just reminded me. There is a picture that I found. So this is the film screen debut of Megan Mullally, which if you see in Discord, I put a picture in there. She walks by in the background for one frame or something. So someone on Twitter found, hi, I'm Megan Mullally, and put her in the back there. So, you know, Mrs. Nick Offerman.
And that's crazy, Joe. We just did the City of Angels Revisited with Nick Offerman in that. So.
And that'll actually be out. That came out yesterday as you're listening to this, so. This is our week of Ron and Tammy 2. So. So the other thing I wanted to read about the casting was that Paul Brickman, who wrote and directed this, saw Tom Cruise in Taps and said, this guy for Joel, this guy's a killer, let him do Amityville 3. Because I think the producers wanted him and he didn't.
Amityville 3D.
Third time's a charm. So Tom Cruise said, somehow my agent, without knowing, arranged to have me just drop by the office to say hello. So I went in wearing a jean jacket. My tooth was chipped, I guess from the Outsiders. My hair was greasy, I guess also from the Outsiders. I was pumped up and talking in an Oklahoma accent. Hey, how y'all doing? Paul just sat there looking at me. Cruise returned to Tulsa but flew back to LA and auditioned again. I walk in and see this stunningly gorgeous woman sitting there looking at me, and I'm thinking, oh my God. Rebecca De Mornay had already been cast. They wanted to see the two of us together. I tested and make a short story long. We didn't test that well. Paul just believed in me. However, this is not what he said, Tom Cruise and Rebecca De Mornay started dating on set, so they obviously tested in real life pretty well. So lots of things going on behind the scenes here. But that's enough of me talking. I am tired of hearing my own voice. Walt, we have a little bit more structure here on these shows, even though it does not seem. What was your favorite moment of Risky Business?
My favorite part of the movie. There's a scene where, like, the car falls into the lake. And I think the thing that I like about this movie in general is that it has a habit of, like, always raising the stakes. If they think that they solved a problem, well, the problem's escalating quickly. And, like, it's kind of very save the caddy at times, where it's very much, oh, this goes right, and then this happens, and then, oh, this goes right, and then this happens. And I mean, that's nice in a movie. This one feels like that was the moment where it goes from being a romantic comedy where, oh, it's a misunderstanding between a professional and an amateur, and then it kind of accelerates to, okay, we're going to put on a brothel. I just think that, again, like, Cruz is always at his best, and I don't think that this was proven then, but like we've seen since that Cruz is always at his best when he's kind of on his heels, and he's always like trying to fix a problem that he himself cannot solve by himself, and it's always fun. And I think that that scene really kind of distills like, oh no, things went really left, and there was nothing that he could do to stop it. It was just kind of a very much like, okay, this movie's serious about moving the plot forward. So I thought it was jarring enough that I did not see it coming, and that I enjoyed like the left swing, you know?
Yeah. I really like that part. I really feel like this movie does a great job of constantly raising the stakes. Like he makes one call that just snowballs, just keeps going downhill, you know, all the while this entire movie up until the very end when like he comes home and is and he's been robbed. Like it just keeps going, you know, as bad as calling the character Good Son is, I feel like this is a really well-written movie. Like, you know, this could be taught, like the structure here is very tight.
Yeah, the director of this is fascinating because like, again, it seems like he had a story to tell and he told it. And to his credit, he, you know, finished it right there. And whether or not he got disenchanted with the industry after is I think like really fun. But I think that there's I have a lot of admiration for people who set out to do something, tell a story that they really, really want to tell, accomplish that story, and then do not feel the need to kind of milk that, kind of like the anti J.K. Rowling or the anti George Lucas, right? Like, but in general, this movie like really killed at the box office, and you would think that he would have a ticket to ride. I just guess that he wasn't interested in kind of continuing with it. But again, I just think that really, so much of this movie is done in the direction, because even though Cruz is absolutely a movie star and you can tell it, this movie feels like a really important turning point for him. And it's kind of like a very unique story that you kind of feel like only he can tell.
Considering how well a lot of the movie works, like in that regard, it's surprising to me how little this guy has written and directed. Like he only directed, I think, 3 movies. He's written mm-hmm. about 8. For somebody who makes this movie that is beloved or iconic or such a key part in Tom Cruise's life, and it seems like pretty, you know, like Walt was saying, successful at the box office, and I think well-respected and well-liked by fans. I wonder what happened to the guy, because it seems like he should do more, because this is a good movie.
Read your trivia, Joey. Read your trivia.
Well, is there, do you know trivia about it?
Yeah, he just got so jaded by the process during this film, because they changed his ending, that he really didn't feel like directing again.
I did read that they read the ending, that he wanted a more depressing ending, and the positive ending of him just with, you know, with Lana in the park or whatever tested better. I don't know, man. Like, come on, just
I had a quick question about the scene that Walt picked out. And so watching it this time, I was watching it real closely, and you know, come to find out, like, it's somewhat of a long con, this whole movie, you know, with Guido and, you know, some of the other girls.
Joey Pants.
There's the shot of her grabbing her purse from the car, and she accidentally removes the brake or whatever. Do you think that she did that intentionally to sort of try and get the ball rolling? Because she comes up with that idea and he
rejects it. To get the ball rolling or to get the car rolling?
There you go. Because like that's when she comes up with the idea. She's like, you know, we could basically turn your house into a whorehouse for the weekend and like bank. And he's like, no. And then he needs the money for the car now, so like he's trapped and he has to do it.
I think it was on purpose. That's my theory.
One thing that I really, really like about this movie is that you never really know whether she's genuine or conning him. The end of even if this is the happy ending, I still don't feel like it's a happy ending, like, because he still feels kind of like young, dumb, and full of cum. Like, she says at one point, like, they say, like, our age, but I think she's probably a couple years older, maybe. She just seems so much smarter than he is, just in, like, common sense. Like, he might have the book smarts and the very, very average SAT scores and grades to get into Princeton, apparently. She's got him wrapped around her little finger throughout the entire movie, and I like that you never really know just how in on it she is with Guido and with Vicky.
And that's what I really love this about this movie, which is like, all of these boys in this movie are dumb, rich schmucks. There's like no reason, like they're not good at things. They're in clubs. They don't run business, right? They're dealing with women who are savvy professionals at this. And they think that they're on top of it because they're used to being on top of stuff because they have money and they're the future entrepreneurs of America. But the people that they're dealing with are way out of their league. Like Tom Cruise thinks that he can out business a pimp and he can't. And like, because all of the guys in this movie are idiots. The moment that Cruz like gets savvy about it. And he's just like, oh, I'm going to hustle these other marks and get them to pay me a bunch of money so that I can do this business with my friend, is like the moment where he kind of comes into his own. It's where he kind of realizes like, oh no, I do know nothing. This person knows how to do this. I'm just going to follow her lead and manage to bamboozle all these dumb idiots into coming to my place. And I like really, really like that part of it, where it's a movie where everybody, there's that joke about like Washington, where everybody thinks that they're in the West Wing, but they're really in Veep. And that's what I like about this movie, is that all the guys think that they're Patrick Bateman, but they're all idiots. And I think that this movie really revels in the space in between with the competence that they think that they have and the competence that they in fact have. And it's a fun play on that, at the very least.
I think the director wanted the movie to be called White Boys Off the Lake, which is a line that's said in this movie, but I think that just goes to show, like, he's a mark. He's just a dumb kid who is, I mean, this whole, you know, when he goes into sales mode, which is amazing, when he's got the glasses on, smoking cigarettes, going from, like, you know, pizza place to pizza place or whatever.
I called it Ferris Bueller mode.
Yeah. Because, you
know. Are we going to talk about the alternate endings? Should I wait to that?
Oh, yeah, no, we can talk about that, but I just, you know, we will talk about all of it, because, there, I mean, there's a lot to talk about.
How I feel about this relates to that.
When he goes into sales mode, I feel like it's just, he's preying on these, like, nerdy guys or overweight guys, the guys who, like, can't get the girls. And I feel like it's interesting, seemingly by choice, that you don't really see girls his age. Like, the only women in this movie, I think, are his mom and all the hookers, all the call girls, whatever they're called.
And his fantasy girls, the two babysitters, quote-unquote.
But, like, you never see... Like, it's not like, you know, in Losing It, Mike, where he had the girlfriend in that one scene, and then he goes down to Mexico, to Tijuana.
Shelley Long, yeah.
Right. But, Brian, why don't you say... You said you had some thoughts about the ending and sort of and what we're talking about.
This is, to me, like, a almost perfect Reagan capitalist film. You know what I'm saying? And I think the original ending was... for me, better.
Do you want to describe the ending so that for people
who
don't know it?
From what I read from the director, and you could watch it on YouTube, but I didn't have the time. Sorry. I read, like, the director's interpretation, and he wanted it to be more, yeah, it was kind of obvious that she was conning him, but now she likes him. And he's not that smart of a guy, but due to his rich white affluence, he was going to advance more in life than her. So now he's almost conning her, and Tom Cruise is kind of saying, like, I don't know if we're going to make it in that kind of way, you know? Because now he's suddenly better than her because he started off better than her, which is terrible, but I feel like more accurate.
Well, I sort of got that sense when he charges her for being with him. Remember at the end, he's like...
Yeah, but he's like, he's doing it like in a jocular tone.
I think it's a joke. Like, I think that's...
I know it's a joke, but I mean, I think the movie is still trying to be metaphorical at that point, and... There's a part that I wanted to mention later on where, like, the movie just does something that, like, kind of makes no sense except to sort of make a point, like, metaphorically, but...
I think it's also, you know, it might be joking at the end, but it's also, you know, this rich, white, good-looking kid who's going to make it in life just because he is rich and young and white and good-looking, sort of already exerting the power. Like, even in a joking manner, but like, hey, you want to spend time with me, pay up, so... This movie can be real depressing if you want to think about it, but it also can be a lot of fun if you don't want to think about it, so...
I love the angle that it is, like, this... It's a business lesson, almost, or thinks it is. Like, it's about kids playing business, because, like, Wall Street was huge, and, like Brian said about, like, Reagan, at the Reagan era, everything like that, like, young entrepreneurs and all that kind of thing, and so I thought that was pretty funny in here, how it's the oldest profession, and, like, he's a young entrepreneur, and I don't know, it's just an interesting premise. You'd think it would be more of a comedy, right? Like, nowadays, this is definitely... If they remade it, it would be just like a wacky boner comedy that would probably stink. I had kind of forgotten just how dramatic and serious like it took itself, and I think it worked like that. I think that was a good way to go.
To an extent, this is the ultimate Reagan-era movie. It's a capitalist story. It's a story of a young idealistic individual who decides to break down and just go into the most capitalist possible business, the oldest business in town. And I mean, like, even like the back, like, it's a pretty Reagan-era movie. Like you mentioned, apparently Tom Cruise was really homophobic behind the scenes. Reagan era movie. Like, there's a lot. This really feels like an extremely 80s movie for a whole bunch of reasons, and in both good and bad ways, obviously, where there are parts that seem a little bit dated at the same time that there are also parts that are like, oh, this story would not have been told 2-3 years earlier.
And there's another bit of trivia on IMDb that 10 years before you know, they would hook up again for Jerry Maguire. Cameron Crowe, I guess, while writing for Rolling Stone, probably interviewed Tom Cruise, and he's like, what's this movie about? And Tom Cruise had this whole, like, that I got rid of because it was all nonsense, but it's about capitalism, it's about this, it's about that. So, like, they were all, you know, like, it's about all that sort of stuff. But, yeah, this is a very Reagan-era, in all regards, mostly bad. So, Brian, what about you? What was your favorite moment in this movie?
I was going to say the car, but that already, you know, was said.
But you can say the car.
Yeah, no, but, the car. But I really like to see, not that I agreed with what happened, but I like to see that Princeton admissions guy show up. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
That guy was not fazed by anything.
Richard Mazur's his name, and he appears in two high school films of note. One,
License to Drive.
License to Drive, he's the dad. We haven't done that one yet on my show. But so we did Encino Man, where he's also the dad. So I was pretty happy to see him. I mean, I liked the party, how they kept upping the stakes. And I liked when Joey Pants picks up the phone at her apartment, you know?
Brian, I actually want to know your opinion here. You at this point are a connoisseur, or like an expert at high school era movies. And I guess I'm wondering is like, how does this stack up? It feels like there's a lot of the beats of a high school movie in here. You've got a car getting ruined in a high school scene. And there's a lot of different like elements here that seem to be kind of a core chunk of the 80s canon. And so I guess from your point of view as like somebody who's really steeped in this stuff, like where does this movie stack up?
I don't know. See, and Mike had a good point about this because most of the time this stuff happens, it's in comedy movies. This is one of the only like dramas I've seen where house party gone awry, car gets fucked up. Though it happens a lot. Where it stacks up, I don't know. I'm not really a scholar. I just have fun with these things.
But. No, I mean, but Brian, like, don't undersell what you've done. Like, you're like the episode that comes out today. Fridays are for fun, you know. It's your 43rd episode. Like, you've done a shit ton of high school movies, and I joked about with you, like, even after 10, that it feels, in times and ways, that you're watching the same movie over and over again,
oh,
because
absolutely.
There's, like, the same beats over and over again, so...
And I'm not complaining.
Don't undersell yourself. Like, you've seen more high school movies, at least, especially in the last year, than all three of us combined, probably, so don't sell yourself short. You could get into Princeton on your high school merits.
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah, and, you know, just, like, the whole... Getting laid, right? Getting laid premise. Like, that is...
Well, that was another thing, too. Like this hits a lot of these high school film beats. Like, almost... Not, I don't want to say all of them, but almost all the 80s, 90s beats. Getting laid. Like, that's, like, the end-all, be-all of most high school films up until, like, recently. So I'll save some of my stuff for the negative things. This is pretty, like, up there in terms of... In terms of high school dramas...
Yeah,
this is pretty up there because, like I said, most films I do that are like high school films with from the point of view of the high schooler are comedies.
Well, I think that this movie sort of reels you in with the comedy, and then it's just like, oh no, this is a lot more serious. Although I think you can also make it's a dark comedy, I think, but I think you could make a point that this is a comedy through and through. That just like that life kind of catches up to him because he's doing dumb things, right? Like we're talking about the snowball effect, like. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah, well, I definitely caught myself like laughing to myself, like about how just much more trouble he keeps getting into. But I feel like it's more played about like character comedy, not situation. I mean,
yeah.
Don't get me wrong, like it's a wacky situation by all means, but like
it doesn't feel wacky, you know.
I feel like they're really Joel is pretty solid, like really well set up and crafted, and you're like, yeah, like this is not gonna be. The sort of hero white boy that I'm sort of used to seeing in an 80s movie, right? Like, usually the lead white guy's got, like Ferris Bueller, like I said earlier, you know? Like, that's what came to mind, and this is not. Like, he might be good-looking and stuff, but he does not have all the right moves to lose it.
Oh, whoa. Before and after, the ghost of Cruise past and future, and past and present.
So that's pretty interesting, I feel, for, you know, that's kind of out of the box, like, for the lead of a 80s movie, you know, most of the time they have all the answers, like, you know, everything goes right, it's, you know, we could get out of this, don't worry, let's just keep going, and, like, I feel like this is a little different in that regard.
Well, what else works for you, Mike? What's your favorite moment in this movie?
So there's a lot, you know, I don't want to pick the obvious, like, the dance scene was fun to revisit. I liked his dream sequences a lot, I thought those were good, but a moment that stuck out at me that just tickled my filmmaker bone, I guess. Like, okay, so like early on, we only see his parents from Joel's point of view. And I was like, oh, this is an interesting shot. Yes. It's like a very long take, and we're following him around the house and this and that. And then there's another shot of Joel's point of view driving to the airport. And then there's another shot in the airport. Yeah. I was like, this is epic. Yeah. I was like, why do one when you could do several and keep it going? And it really just hammers home, like, okay, I know exactly how he feels about his parents and how they feel about him and, you know, look down on him and all this and that. And so I think that was one of my favorite parts this time.
You know, I want to say that sort of ties into mine. It's weird at first, but I like how most of this movie kind of feels like a dream, and almost none of it is. Like, there's two dream sequences that are kind of masturbation fantasies. Like, this is a movie in which Tom Cruise jerks off. Like, we see him start to jerk off, which I was like, what? But, you know, aside from the times he's fantasizing about the girl in the shower or, you know, the babysitter or whoever, this all happened, I guess, in this world. But yet, that doesn't mean that, like, when Rebecca De Mornay comes over, the wind blows open the back door, leaves start to blow in there while they're having sex immediately. Like, I was just, it's all like heightened and crazy. And I like that there's like this surreal vibe, yet it's still like a grounded movie. Like, I don't know how better to describe it, but it's this weird blend of real and fantasy that all winds up being real for the most part.
That's a good call, Joey, because that really puts you in his frame of mind. Reality to him is not reality, right? Like, his perspective is what, like, he's treating this moment like a fantasy, and I feel like that leads into how naive he is, like, in the next morning, and how he gets tricked into letting her stay, and he just becomes, you know, like, pussy whip, sorry, for lack of a better term. Like, he's got it, he doesn't want to get rid of it, he'll do whatever he can to keep it, and then, you know, once that egg is lost, metaphor, I think, he'll do anything to get it back. So, like, yeah, he's in a predicament.
Well, what I think is also really kind of interesting, you know, like, this is his fantasy, but, you know, when he's being chased by Guido, right, like, he and his friend go to that hotel or whatever to find Lana, and they see her there, and she's with a guy, and he, like, does his little, like, there is a shot from the trailer for Widows, which has been used in every year-end montage I've seen, but it's that shot of Daniel Kaluuya and Brian Tyree Henry, Paperboy from Atlanta, and Daniel Kaluuya does, like, that, like, little, like, wave with his, like, two fingers, like, it's, like, this menacing gesture, which is also super fucking cool, and it reminds me, like, in this movie, in a way that, like, he does his, like, weirdo kind of wave, like, I see you, I got you, and then she leaves, and his friend's like, wait, that was your play? Like, that's all you got? They go outside, they find her, Guido starts chasing them, they drive away, but what I think is interesting, long story short, in that getaway, and earlier in the movie when he smokes that guy who, like, challenges him to a race at that stoplight, shout out Fast and Furious, it reminds me of The Wolf of Wall Street, like, where Leo is on the, is all fucked up, and he's on the lewds, and you see him drive home and get home safely, and, like, he, like, heroically saves the day, and then, like, you smash cut to, like, what actually happened, and he hits, like, literally every car he passes, and then, like, his car shows up at home, like, completely, like, dismantled and, like, just disgusting wreck. Like, I feel like this whole movie is the vision of, like, what life on lewds is like, but we don't actually see the, like, what life is actually like on lewds. Like, we don't actually get the after. And I feel like that's a really interesting way to, like, frame an entire movie, because he gets away with it all.
Yeah, I love that part of The Wolf of Wall Street, just because, again, it's the dissimilarity between what people think is happening and what is actually happening. And there's a heightened sense of realism, it feels like, through this whole thing, where Tom Cruise is playing a character who sincerely feels as if he's in control, but a, like, simple reading of the of like the plot alone shows that he's the least person in control. There's no possible way that he is running the show in this movie. There's no possible way that he's, like, he's absolutely being led. And I think that there's, like, a super interesting question that you got at earlier, which is, like, is he being led around? Is he of autonomy in this one? Is he being just as fooled as everyone else in this? And it's like, you know, it's a fun question of like this heightened reality. And I think that that's also kind of a credit to the director, because it gets you into that kind of adolescent haze where you're in that mindset where you don't know how the world works and you're trying to figure out how the world works and you're doing a really bad job of it, but you're still doing it and it's going to have consequences for everyone involved. But it's a fun like aesthetic, and I actually like really enjoyed it in this movie.
So now, Walt, if we, you know, we talked a lot about what we like, what did you not like about this movie? Like, what was, did you have a least favorite moment or scene or bit from Risky Business?
Yeah, there were a few things that I didn't love about the movie. I would say that the one that is just kind of the most prominent, I feel like I would not be the only one to bring this up, is like this movie really aged kind of badly, especially on its treatment of sex workers, particularly the first sex worker. Again, like they call in the phone book and it's played as a joke because, again, it's like it's a male actor playing the sex worker. And it just seems like that's the kind of stuff that people got a lot less cool with somewhat more recently than I think that we would hope. Do I think that that movie, that scene would be done as it was right now? No. Do I think that it would have been done that way 5 years ago? Maybe. Do I think it would have been done that way 10 years ago? 150%. I do realize that this is the thing that the culture shifted pretty quickly on, but I think that that's like that like mild latent homophobia of the late 80s is a very prevalent thing that I think is going to kind of smear perfectly fine movies going forward, or just at least make them a little bit wincier to watch. You have to judge art by its situation and its time, but that just felt like a very, very like cruel way of going about it, and a very kind of mean joke that didn't need to happen the way it was. And it feels kind of out of pace with, I think, like the spirit of the rest of the movie in a way that it almost just kind of takes me out of it. But again, like I don't think that I'm saying anything super divisive here, where I think that they handle some stuff kind of negatively early on.
Like, I can see that you need something in between his friend calling the first number he finds in the... Apparently, like, newspapers back in the 80s were like the internet now. Like, it's just all smut. Like, it is graphic in the newspaper.
Yeah, I mean, the classifieds.
Wow. It's like, it's just, it's misconnections, but like, it's wow. You need a buffer of some kind between his buddy calling the first number he sees and then Lana. Because if he calls the number and Lana shows up, it's like, oh, your buddy did you a solid. Like, I get that there needs to be something in between, but it doesn't need to be what this movie goes for. So I agree that that's, you know, not great. I understand why something like that happened, but not that. Also, I'm watching the movie as we record, and it's that scene right now. And another shot that I really love is like when Tom Cruise closes the door and the camera just follows him around the house as he grips the, you know, the phone off the charging cable or whatever, and then just keeps doing laps in this house. Like, it's just like such little things like that, or big things or whatever, that are just so... so cool.
You know what else was kind of funny is that later on in the movie, he mentions that he calls this person Jackie, who shows up. He calls her to find out where Lana is. I just thought that was kind of interesting. Like, hey, I still got this number. I guess I don't know. There was just something weird about that. But
he's resourceful, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
Brian, what was your least favorite moment in Risky Business?
I already mentioned that I kind of would have preferred the more morbid ending. I have to hit on the same points. That kind of stuff was a lot of dated shots, if you will, you know, in terms of, it's definitely like a male gaze-y film.
Oh yeah, this is like a total straight white boy, like high school sex fantasy movie.
Which is funny, it's because...
Like 9.5 weeks for a teenager or something.
Yeah, like, again, normally you see a lot of cheap comedy, like high school comedies that are about that. It's just like a well-regarded drama, and I was kind of surprised, like, just little things, like, even at the end scene, like, how you could just, her dress, they're, like, walking through a park, and her dress is, like, see-through for no apparent reason.
Fashion, baby!
That was not fashion, okay?
No, it's style, it's, yeah, no, yeah, I mean, it just, it fits the demographic and the need of the tone of what they're going for. I feel like this whole movie, like, you could do it with adults or something. I don't know. Like, it feels like they're playing house in a way, or like, you know, we got a bunch of kids to do this grown-up movie. And it's, yeah, it's like, instead of all these teen comedies, like, we get an adult teen movie or something like that. I agree. It's kind of strange. I think when they do it nowadays, it's not as obvious or something, right? Like, I can't even really throw a name out there at the moment, but, you know, serious teen dramas are probably just done a lot better these days, I guess.
Yeah, it made me, like, more uncomfortable than a comedy would, and I'm not sure why, if that makes sense.
Well, even think of, like, The Edge of 17, which is, like, a really great movie, and I get uncomfortable watching it just because, like, I'm a really old guy watching, like, really young people deal with, like, sex and stuff like that, and, you know, and it's emotional, and that's good, though. That you should be affected in a lot of different ways. That's what, like, a good movie does, I guess, right? Like, make you uncomfortable when it should, and happy when you should, and so forth.
Yeah, true.
In terms of the, I guess, unusual type of story, maybe for kids, or, you know, a sort of a continuation of what you were just talking about, that the director cited Bertolucci's The Conformist from 1970, which I have not seen, but has a very high rating on Letterboxd, which is about a weak-willed Italian man becomes a fascist flunky who goes abroad to arrange the assassination of his old teacher, now a political dissident.
Hmm.
And the director of this said, that was a huge influence on this. I thought, why can't you present that as a film for youth and aspire to that kind of style and still have humor in it? That was the test, to meld the darker form of filmmaking with humor. Tone is what I wanted to play with. And I think if we had gotten the downer of an ending, I think this would have been less of a celebration of young, rich white men. You know what I mean? Like, I think that if you have the first, say, 90 minutes of it be like, oh, he's going to get away with it. Like, this kid, you know, he's going to be handed life on a silver platter, and, you know, his parents come back, and there's all they notice that there's a small crack in the egg because it's a pay for it or whatever. And then if you find out that, like, he's not going to have it all. Like, I feel like that's sort of like a, remember that, like, that fun you thought you were having, it's not actually there, but with the better ending or the positive ending or whatever, it just sort of, it sort of feels like we're celebrating a little bit too much, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess every negative part of this movie for me is just more me hating the kind of things that actually exist in society, and that's not the film's fault, so.
Right, I mean, like, the train scene, I just have so many issues with it as a regular commuter in and of myself. Like, first of all, like, the person on that train who was just, like, again, trying to, like, give them the eyes until they just left to a different car or stopped doing that on that train. Like, he is all of us. He's just trying to commute. He's had a couple. He's trying to get home. And then what happens to him? Tom Cruise grabs him, hurls him out of a train car, sits him down, makes him miss a train and have to wait hours to go home just so that he can get with the girl inside of a train car of all. Like, this guy had a car, right? Like, there's limit, like, his parents aren't home. There's limitless options as to where he can take this girl. And instead, he takes to a weird one train car that is going through an infinitely long tunnel. I know that you guys are enormously fond, as I am, of the Fast and the Furious movies. And if anything, this magical tunnel circling the entirety of Lake Michigan reminded me of that really, really long runway from, what was it, like, Fast 5 or Fast 6. It was a loss of suspension for disbelief. And just, it really took me out because I've seen what goes down on those seats, and you do not want to hook up with anybody on those seats.
I mean, yeah, as you know, one of the two New Yorkers on this podcast, I mean, you would know better than me in terms of, I guess, how realistic that is. But Brian, have you run into that kind of experience on your subway adventures?
No, I mean, the germs. The germs. I
Yeah. Especially back then, like, it feels, you know, that was before Rudy Giuliani cleaned up the city, right? So
this is Chicago.
Yeah, this is Chicago. So I don't know.
York, oh, it's not New York. That's true. Yeah. It feels like New York.
It's before Batman cleaned up the city.
So. Yeah.
As, like, a transit junkie, I was very confused by, I guess, the late night train in Chicago at the time only has one car.
It's just unrealistic. Like, the idea is the car is covered in gonorrhea. You have to shovel drunks out of it. And worst of all, think about it this way. There's like, they think that they're alone in that car, but this is the 80s. These trucks aren't operated by robots. Like, there's a driver in the car. It's a trolley who, I'm sure that if he looked in his rear view, he would see a teenager and a local prostitute just going to town on ultra gonorrhea covered seats. I know that at the time this must have been a sexy scene, but knowing what we know now, but actually, no, this couldn't have been a sexy scene back then because they had germ theory in the 80s. Like, there's no way that it's like when you see places in movies from where you're from, or like, oh no, it's not like that at all, or ew, no, why would they do that? It's like, that's like, anybody who is from a city where you ride on a train would under no circumstances do anything. Like, I wouldn't do anything medical on a train. I wouldn't put a contact lens in a train. Like, it just takes me out of it. And, like, I'm sure that, like, that must have been a formative memory for a lot of people who watch Risky Business, but for me, it's just absolutely gut-wrenching to watch, and I did not enjoy that.
Well, the one thing that I will say, and this is, again, just to prove that I read your newsletter every day, is that at least this is the kind of gonorrhea before it became super gonorrhea. So this is still, antibiotics can still take care of that, even though they are definitely getting infected by stuff just from, like, having sex in, like, a disgusting germ-ridden train car. But, yeah.
I mean, like I was saying, it's just extremely impractical. I don't care for it. There's no, like, they had other places to go. I'm sure the lighting was cool, but, like, the elevated train is not the place for the situation. It was just, it took me out of it. I didn't care for it at all.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of the sex in this movie doesn't look comfortable.
No.
Like, there's the practical scene, you know, when Rebecca De Mornay shows up and they have, like, I guess, like, upright sex by the chilly open, you know, the wind blowing in. Then they go to the stairs, mm-hmm. and then they go to that, like,
a chair.
Maybe comfortable, maybe uncomfortable office chair in front of a TV with the American flag literally blowing on the TV. Like,
oh, well, that's the end of the broadcast day. You know, they used to. The American flag and the national
flag. Do you remember that from your childhood, Mike?
Yeah, you should have. When the TV was first invented, it was only on for a couple hours, and we'd all sit around watching the test pattern.
And it was just the anthem on the radio, right?
Well, we had George and Gracie. They were there. And Little Orphan Annie. She was popular.
All right, old man Mike, what's your least favorite moment of Risky Business?
I totally agree with our guests so far. I want to try and pick something else. There's definitely not enough Joey Pants in this movie. Great seeing him pop up. Him and Cruz have that great scene in the front yard. And I just love the way he ignores Joel as a person and just plays him. I guess I'll go with the real one, then I'll save this for sort of final thoughts. I'll save the other thing.
But okay.
I really kind of hated that one friend of his who was already getting laid a lot. I don't know why it bothered me so much, but they were portraying, like, the one kid who had a girlfriend and then cheated on his girlfriend with one of the prostitutes later as, like, really awesome and cool and, like, you know, made fun of Tom Cruise a lot for being a virgin and took advantage of him and, like, just had sex in his house a lot.
That's, oh,
like,
yeah, when really, he comes over
really
the beginning.
Really bothered me.
Yeah, yeah, that's weird. That's real weird.
Yeah, I didn't like that.
I'm looking through my notes to try to find what I like the least that hasn't already been said, and I'm just finding things that I really enjoyed, like little touches, like the neighborhood kids who are just watching the show that is this house. Like, they're always just on the front lawn, like, watching the party or watching the moving truck at the end or just, like, watching, you know, the call girls go in and out. Like, they're just there a lot.
You could tell, yeah, that's pre-internet. That's pre-Nintendo, you know, like, they weren't inside doing much these days.
I like when after the Porsche goes into the water and they bring it to the shop and they open the door, the water comes out and there's just, like, fish swimming around. Like, I think I like that touch a lot. I love how cute Rebecca De Mornay looks when she puts on his sunglasses for one scene. She says at one point, I think on the phone, she says, ciao. And I had the subtitles on because I was writing down a quote, and the subtitles just say, speaks Italian. So I liked that.
I was starting to wonder if the Curtis Armstrong character was real, just because my mind always is going in that direction. But I was like, is he projecting that character? But then other characters are
like
no,
that Ferris Bueller
theory,
right?
Yeah, like the Cameron theory and all that kind of, because, like, I mean, he is at the poker game in the beginning. He is talking to other characters, but when he's just talking to Cruz, they're like these really deep moments and stuff, and that's when he gives him the what the fuck advice and everything, and or you just have to say what the hell or whatever. I don't know. I was having fun with that again.
The point where Tom Cruise actually does say, where Joel does say what the fuck after the Princeton interview goes very poorly, and he puts on the sunglasses and just like, what the fuck, and then he, like, does that, like, little shrug, like, I guess it's the University of Illinois. Apparently that was improvised. That's still, like, a cool, like, little, like, there's a lot of, I think, shots in this movie and looks that are, again, to use your word, Brian, iconic, that they're just, like, I think it's a lot around the glasses, it's a lot around Tom Cruise's, you know, million-dollar smile, around the cigarette and stuff. Like, it's just, like, this whole repeated image, this motif, if you will, of just this bulletproof kid.
So this is kind of a question for y'all. I mean, I know that I don't have a ton of experience with the ultra-early Cruise, and so I guess what I'm wondering is, like, so when I was watching this movie, it felt like, in a credit to the director, it felt like the director absolutely knew what he had in Tom Cruise in many ways before a lot of other people did, because, like, he can tell that, okay, you point a camera at Tom Cruise, you're going to get good tape. If you keep Tom Cruise in the frame, you're going to have a livelier movie. It's one of the situations where I think that this pops up, like, throughout Tom Cruise's career. Like, this is an actor who lights up the screen when he's in it. He's the kind of person that you always want to look at. For some reason, he's got, like, he has the discipline and like the notion of where what his angles are, where he always looks good on frame. And I think that this is a movie directed or at least shot by somebody who is 100% certain of this and who knows that the more that you have Tom Cruise on screen, the better your movie is going to be. And so I guess like my question to you guys is like, was this the first movie that kind of really made sure that Tom was on screen the whole time? Or like, was this an earlier thing that was picked up in like Bosom Buddies? Or not Bosom Buddies, that's the other guy.
The interesting thing, so this is our fifth episode. This is his fifth movie. From the fourth thing he was in, so from the last episode onward, he's never not the lead again. So, like, very, very quickly, they were like, oh, this, he's going to be a star. Like, yeah. He can carry a movie.
Yeah, and his first appearance, he as Billy the Arsonist.
Oh, it's so good.
In Endless Love, he's mm-hmm. in one scene for, like, half a minute.
It's 47
or a minute and
seconds.
A half. It's electric.
It's so
like,
good.
Who is this? Where can I see more of this? Like, this is insane. Who is this kid out of nowhere? And then in every subsequent movie it's like that, and especially Taps. I think in Taps yeah. it's like, wow, I'm like, he, this kid is going places. Like, he's going toe-to-toe with like all these Sean Penn, everyone yep. else. Like, he really kind of took that movie.
And I know that we're a little biased in that we're watching these movies for him, so there he's always gonna catch our eye, but I feel like in these movies so far, it's like, yes, he's the one to watch. Although, maybe a little bit different in The Outsiders, just because, like, The Outsiders is filled with, like, the one to watch. It's, like, it's like, oh, yeah. Rob Lowe, he's going to be huge. Patrick Swayze, he's going to be huge. Like, it's all those kind yeah. of people, you know what I mean? So
I know this isn't the case, but it feels like one of those instances where it's designed for him to be a bigger star or something, where, like, the studio would get together and say, what do we got for this Tom Cruise kid that would, like, you know, catapult him or, like, get people to remember him and stuff? Like, let's find this kid a movie to, like, break out. And I know he, you know, like, auditioned and got the role and stuff, but, like, yeah, it just kind of reminded me of back in, like, the old days where they would, like, manufacture a star. And I think, you know, they still do that from time to time and in different ways and stuff, but it just seems like in the 80s, when people were really on the rise, like, you could catapult into superstardom very quickly if you had, like, what it took.
And I think the interesting thing is the last movie we did, Losing It, which is this ostensibly a sex comedy where four high school students go down to Mexico to lose their virginity, and then it becomes this, like, weird movie where, like, Jackie Earle Haley just wants to get Spanish Fly so he can date rape girls, not an exaggeration, and that Tom Cruise falls in love with Shelley Long as this older woman who gets divorced or wants to get divorced. And, like, it's this whole thing that, like, it's not a sex comedy halfway through the movie. And that movie, again, like, slows down when Tom Cruise isn't on screen. Like, he's got this very weird emotional through line that doesn't really make sense with the rest of the movie. But whenever, like, Jackie Earle Haley or this other guy who's just an asshole are on screen, it's just like, well, yeah, like, but let's get back to that guy. Or let's get back to the younger kid, because, you know, Jackie Earle Haley's younger brother is also great in that movie. But it feels like that movie didn't realize maybe what it had in Tom Cruise, whereas this movie very clearly does.
Interesting.
And just to sort of round up the least favorite moments, I'm going to say, as someone who has moved four or five times in the last, like, 6 or 7 years, there's absolutely no goddamn way that this house that has been pointed out by multiple people, it's giant and, you know, affluent and, you know, beautiful and filled with expensive stuff. All of the house, all of the belongings in the house fit on, like, a 12-foot moving truck and also, like, casually in the front yard. Like, that is wildly inaccurate. I can tell you that much. So that was my least favorite moment.
That
in the
is
movie.
Troublesome.
I fucking love that moment, though, when, like, Joey Pants is like, I could, like, break your legs if you'd rather or whatever. He's like, I'm being nice. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? For, like, all intent and purpose, as far as, like, movie pimps go, like, this is probably the nicest, like, most sort of, like, understanding. He's like, I'm going to teach you, like a life lesson instead. I'm going to do you one better, kid. Damn, I need more of Joey Pants.
He's like, give me all the money that belongs to me, and we're good. It's like, oh, okay. You know, I guess, Mike, sometimes I say, ignorance is bliss. Harp music, harp music, harp music. I love in this movie that Tom Cruise, like, there's so many Frozen, it feels like this is sponsored by Frozen Dinners, but the first one he eats, I guess he doesn't cook, and he's eating that, like, meat popsicle, like, it's just the entire front tray just frozen.
Yeah,
just weird.
I kind of wish
that
we got a little more sort of Kevin McAllister moments with him mm-hmm. and, like, Home Alone.
I have a new possibility, Mike, for sex, what we can call sex.
This is the second, like, this crosses over with Hanks. Hanks and Sonny had sex depicted by two trains crashing,
yeah.
And he actually, Cruise has sex on a train in this movie.
So I have it. I have separate from that. We don't call sex sex because I think it's funnier to, you know, instead of saying like they had sex, it's like, you know, Cage compromised a woman because that was from The Boy in Blue, or, you know, Keanu in Youngblood in 1986. There's this old woman who ostensibly sleeps with every young hockey player, so she lures them in with tea. So it's sipping tea with Miss McGill. That's what we called sex on that. So we're trying to figure out. We're trying to get our footing here in the Tom Tom Club. What we're gonna call sex. I think it's right before they go, when the friend comes over to have sex in the house, and he's trying to show him the idea for the young enterprisers, right? And it's the memo minder, and he's like, you know, you write down the note, you think this, it flashes the light, you press this other button, it makes a sound or whatever. So I was thinking maybe, you know, as this is all going on, there's like sex, you can hear the grunting and the moaning and the banging upstairs. Maybe minding memos. He was minding memos with her. So just throwing it out there, just as a possibility.
I'll tie up on the list for me.
So that actually, now that scene makes more sense to me. Very ironically, I was watching the first part of this film again on the subway.
Okay.
I did not hear the sex sounds during that
scene. Oh, yes.
So I was like, wait, what? And okay, so thank you for the clarification.
He calls up and it's just like, you know, just lock us. He's so fed up with it. He's like, lock up on your way out. They don't respond. And that's what he says, you know, moan twice if you understand. And she goes, and he's like, all right, and then he leaves.
Quick subway, or not, I guess it's not subway in Chicago, but I did look up some transit facts. I know your fans are big transit junkies.
Of course, especially of the band Chicago Transit Authority. So.
So there was no single car transit lines in 1983. And the specific line they were on from that lake area did not have underground stations. It was completely above ground. That would bother me if I was from Chicago.
Brian, you are ruining the movie magic of this movie. One thing that actually sort of disappoints me, and this is like one of the last notes I have, is that, you know, the movie starts out by Joel's dad. This is the scene that Mike was talking about before where we're in Tom Cruise's POV, and Joel's dad brings him over to the little cabinet, and he's like, do you hear anything different about the music? And Tom Cruise is like, no, I don't. He's like, maybe there's a little bit more bass, and the dad, like, adjusts the equalizer exactly where he wants it. I feel like the movie sets up the dad to be this, like, very particular person who notices things, and so I feel like at the end, when they come back, when they fly back, Brian and Mike, we have a little bit of a Sean's dad moment here, where Tom Cruise is like, no, you said the sixth, not the fifth. What are you talking about? Awesome. So a little bit of a Tokyo Drift call out there. I think it's weird, and maybe it's not. Maybe I'm making a bigger deal of it, but that's kind of the whole point of podcasts, making a big deal about things. But I feel like it's weird that the mom notices something and not the dad. Like, it would have been great if the dad was like, oh, the equalizer is like wildly, or something like, you know what I mean? Like, the movie sets up the dad as the guy to notice it, and then the mom notices it. And it's just like, well, all right.
That leads into my final note. That's crazy you said that, because that jumped out at me as, like, weird and kind of wrong or something. And then later the dad, like, becomes best friends with his son when he finds out, you know, he got his Princeton contact laid and accepted and all. But, like, so here's my final note and, like, my sort of egg theory overall about, like, this movie and stuff. So, like, you know, I feel like the egg is, like, represents Joel in a lot of ways, like his purity and stuff. After he's, like, pulled off this kind of heist and, like, lost his virginity and, like, had sex with prostitutes, all this kind of stuff, right? The mom comes back, holds the egg, and says, there's a small crack inside my egg.
Yep.
The egg is ruined. And I think she's, like, talking about Joel. I don't know. My mind was, like, going nuts. I was like, this feels symbolic. I feel like this is all sort of trying to say something here at the end, that the mom senses something is off about her son and he's never going to be the same again.
I like that a lot.
Like, the little boy is all grown up. It just doesn't affect Joel. Like, he's taking the punishment now. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's sort of, like, I guess, more of a man, I guess, or just taking account for his actions and stuff, but that thought, like, wouldn't get out of my head during that scene, so I had to get it out.
So now, Mike, how high were you when you watched this movie?
Extremely, but, yeah. I mean, you know, that's how you get, like, this insight sometimes.
Walt and Brian, do either of you have any other notes to say about this movie before I do some more trivia, and then we move on to a couple, a game or two and some awards?
I don't know. I'm very happy that I saw this movie. Again, like, for its, like, again, significant problems, I thought it was a lot of fun. I thought that it was, like, it definitely had, like, a feminist take on some of this kind of stuff, in the sense where everybody in this movie is a schmuck besides the women in this movie, and I really enjoyed a lot of things about like the plot and how the boiler was always getting hotter. It felt a little bit formulaic in that way at times, but I had a good time. And thank you for inviting me on to talk about it. I don't know if I would have seen this movie if I hadn't. And so thanks. This was a lot of fun.
Brian, any other last thoughts, or are we good to progress?
Good to go. Let's do it.
So in an effort to make Tom Cruise look more quote unquote teenage, even though he's not too much older here, I think he was 20 instead of 18 or whatever. The producers had him work out a lot, lose 10 pounds, immediately stop working out, and then just start eating like McDonald's and other fatty foods so that he could have like the layer of baby fat. So I think, you know, it works. But he's also, you're trying to take 2 years off. Like, it's not crazy, but you know.
Give him that teen physique.
Timothy Hutton, Mike, who was in Taps, was the first choice for the role of Joel, the Tom Cruise role, but he turned it down for another movie instead.
Oh, do you know what movie?
Daniel by Sidney Lumet.
Okay.
So, Sharon Stone auditioned for the Lana role. Kim Basinger turned down the role of Lana because she didn't like the script. I just feel like they're linked in my brain for like 90s sex movies, sort of. Like adult steamy thrillers.
Yeah.
Your favorite genre.
Instinct.
My favorite genre. Frank Sinatra was considered for the role of Guido, the Joey Pants role, but was deemed, quote, too serious.
My.
Come on.
God.
Right? Old Mickey Blue Eyes, Frankie Blue Eyes. Richard Dreyfuss was considered for the role of Guido.
What? Yeah, I could see that. I could see that.
I see him like Jaws character, and it doesn't make sense.
I mentioned before that Tom Cruise and Rebecca De Mornay started dating while they made the movie. Apparently, she also showed up on set with Harry Dean Stanton, who they had been dating at some point, too. So that made things a little bit awkward on set.
Shout out Twin Peaks.
And like 150 other things.
I know, but we're always shouting out Twin Peaks connections.
So I said I had some Sean Penn trivia, aside from the fact that he auditioned. He is the passenger when Tom Cruise first takes the Porsche out for a joyride. Apparently he's in the passenger seat. So he's just there as a favor. Because he was also in Chicago shooting a movie called Bad Boys, not the Will Smith Bad Boys, a different Bad Boys. And so he and Tom Cruise would hang out because they were friends from the days of Taps. So that's all the trivia I got. So, okay, let us move on to the most important game that we can possibly play, The Other Tom. Now, Walt, Brian's played this already, so I'm going to explain it to you. Pretend for a moment that reality had shifted and Tom Hanks was cast in this role of Joel Goodson instead of Tom Cruise. What would this movie be like if Tom Hanks were the lead?
So there was that period in early Tom Hanks' career where he was a sexual being. And I think that at some point we all agree that stopped, that Tom Cruise continued to be a sexual entity in the minds of America. And Tom Hanks graduated from being a sexual being. That was as late as like Big and all that. Right. And he graduated into being like effectively like a single celled organism in that way, where people just don't imagine him in a really serious or romantic role. And you can see it happen at times. But like, I think in general, at this point in this career, it would have been fine. I think that we would have looked back on this Hanks performance as being very out of line with what he later went on to do, in the same way that we look back on this Cruise performance as being extremely in line with what he wanted to do. But in general, I don't think it would have been too out of place.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Brian, what about you? You've played this game a couple times by putting Tom Cruise in both seasons of Bosom Buddies. How would you think this movie would play out if Tom Hanks was in fact cast as Joel Goodson?
Sonny. I don't know. I mean,
who is it?
It's really, really, really tough. I just don't see it as a movie. I see it more as, like I was saying before, like a comedy, like a early Tom Hanks sex comedy. I can't see his voice delivering some of these lines. Not that he's not capable of it. It just doesn't feel right to me.
Well, yeah, Tom Cruise does have a smarminess, like when he, you know, at the end of the movie where it's cutting back and forth. Again, a really cool scene, a really cool edited scene where he's, you know, sort of dealing with the aftermath of his actions. And there's the kids at school because for being late to school, he gets suspended for 5 days and gets kicked out of his club?
Not just for being late, for threatening
the nurse.
Okay. Yeah, no, that was... I forgot to mention that. Super uncalled for. Like, don't put your hands on that lady.
Yeah, no. Just take it like a man and take your detention and walk away.
Yeah, but, you know, at the end when they're cutting back and forth between the aftermath of what he did and also the kid still in the club, like, saying, I made $500. He has that whole, like, monologue that is basically, you know, I'm going to be fine because I made $8,000 in one night, and sometimes you have to say what the fuck and whatever. And I do feel like that is, you know, not necessarily a thing that we've seen so far that Tom Hanks could deliver. So I agree with you there, Brian.
So I've thought about this a little bit about like Tom Hanks and Tom Cruise obviously had a very similar early career. And I think that I figured it out, which is basically, I think that if you took the five meanest characters that Tom Hanks ever played, they're still nicer than the five nicest characters that Tom Cruise played. So in the sense that, like, even like the meanest and worst people played by Hanks are still, on the aggregate, if you level it out, better than the Cruise folks, because the Cruise folks are, like, even if they are, like, to get D&D-y, they're not lawful. They're like chaotic neutral or neutral or chaotic good, whereas like the Hanks people tend to be kind of straight and narrow. And yes, Hanks has played villains once or twice, but like if you kind of like do the averages, then I think that the floor of cruelty with Hanks versus Cruise is just like the Cruise folks are a little bit smarmier. They're a little bit, like, you know, meaner.
Oh, are we including Cloud Atlas in that list?
That's the true Mike. Mike, what about you? What if Tom Hanks was in this movie? How would it play out?
I think it would be funnier, you know? Like, I think they'd probably lean more into that, because I feel like at this time, Hanks is just much more comfortable doing that. Like, I just feel like he's more natural with the comedy. When he got serious on Bosom Buddies, or in the movies we've seen him in so far, especially as Pardew in Mazes and Monsters, Rona Jaffe's Mazes and Monsters, that got real kind of somber and boring and, like, lost me for a while. I was like, this is just not good Hanks right now. So I don't know. I don't think it would be as good. I think we get his sort of boy meets girl movie soon with Splash, right? Like, it's everything but like the prostitution. It's like him meeting a beautiful woman and them, like, trying to, you know, be a couple and all
no
that.
No spoilers.
Kind of stuff. I'm not. That's not a spoiler. I mean,
there's romance in a romance movie.
There's a huge twist on the back of the DVD. I'm not even going to mention.
Well, a mermaid, right? Daryl Hannah's a mermaid.
What?
I know that.
Yeah. I mean, okay. You forced me.
I kind of know that because they want to reboot it, I think, with Channing Tatum in a gender swap. So he's going to be the merman, yeah, which I cannot wait for. But anyway.
But that's my point, though. It's like, to get to this level of drama, it has to be in a I'm in love with a mermaid movie at this time in his career. Like, I really think that's a great movie and he pulls it off in there. So I just don't know if he had it. If he could do a straight drama like this right now, he definitely gets there in his career. Like, you know what I'm saying? He becomes a terrific dramatic actor. Yeah, just at this time, I just think, you know, kind of like I guess Brian was saying, like, it would just become more of like an American Pie of that time as opposed to something as serious, I think.
You know, I'm going to take a real simple stance here. I think with Tom Hanks here, we're going to pull a Bosom Buddies and just have the downer of an ending.
Oh, okay.
Like,
yeah,
he's just, his influence just direction. Makes it. So, Walt, I don't know. Have you seen Bosom Buddies, Walt? Have you watched, like, any episodes or all the episodes? Or
I am not in any way familiar with Bosom Buddies. I think I watched an episode of it once for a thing that I wrote about Tom Hanks, but I've not done as much of a walkthrough. Please tell me more.
What one thing that we learned, because Brian was on both episodes about that, so the three of us have watched all 37 episodes of Bosom Buddies, there are like more than a handful of episodes that are ostensibly just a comedy for, you know, 22 minutes, and then the last minute and a half, it's Tom Hanks like, I don't want to grow up. I'm afraid of being an adult, and it's just, and that's how the episode ends.
What have I
it's
done
like,
with my life?
It's like, wait, what?
Like we're mortal. We've realized that.
Yeah.
Episode ends.
Yeah, you almost expect them to find out that they're TV characters.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's nothing worth
living
for.
It's like this existential dread in these movies, in these episodes. And I feel like based on that, we would have the weird sort of depressing ending here, because that's just kind of Hanks's thing, I guess, so far between Bosom Buddies and also, you know, the Mazes and Monsters movie, the D&D movie, where it starts this, like, you know, beautiful nerds playing D&D, turns into him becoming separated from reality.
Trapped in his character, yeah.
His thing so far has been fun up front, real depressing in the end. So I think we would have had the downer of the ending here, which, you know, he would have willed it into being. Maybe he would have sold it more. I don't know. Maybe it would have worked better for the test audiences. Who knows?
Compare like what happens when Tom Cruise and Tom Hanks play a movie about a guy in a plane. Like, it's Tom Cruise as like the sexy fighter pilot, and it's Tom Hanks as the like crusty but steady airline pilot who successfully saves an entire crew of people who fall into the Hudson River. Like, that's exactly what they are.
And what I was going to say is that they both had to deal with geese. Goose and geese.
Oh, good connection.
Oh, dude.
Did you notice the other Cruise Hanks connection in this film?
What is it?
Well, as we all know, Tom Hanks dances on a piano in Big.
I haven't seen Big yet, but go on.
Come on.
Whoa.
That's not even a spoiler, okay?
I know.
No, my reaction was more for he hasn't seen the movie yet. Not
I think that might have been a movie that I saw part of in school, but I definitely have not seen the whole thing. Isn't in The Night Before, not the Keanu Night Before, but the Seth Rogen Night Before?
Oh, yeah, I think they
copy Schwartz that, but they do the Runaway, the Kanye song, right? So he dances on the piano, and then in the end here, Cruz runs on the piano,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we briefly get a foot on a piano in this, so.
Yeah, Cruz running.
Connection.
Okay, well, we've got one more game, and then we get the awards. In this world, you have won a walk-on role. You are going to Stan Lee yourself as a cameo in this movie. Where do you put yourself in Risky Business?
I think I would definitely be easy. Yes, no, easy. I would absolutely be the vagrant on the train who is pushed out of it, much to his own chagrin, by Tom Cruise. Yes, I am the train drunk vagrant.
I like that a lot. That is a perfect answer. Brian, can you top that?
I was thinking about this the whole time I was watching, and I could not figure it out. Kind of a similar thing, and it was mentioned before. I kind of want to be the train conductor here.
Oh, are we all going to be on the train?
I don't know, maybe. And I want to kind of let them know that, I'm still here, guys. Please don't do this.
Mike, are you going to play the gonorrhea on the seat?
No. I'm going to be the world's best mechanic because apparently the guy at the Porsche dealership can fix that car overnight.
No, yeah.
He is a magician. That's me. I'd be the man if that was me.
Actually, I have a question for you guys. What's the time frame of this movie?
Aren't they just gone for the weekend? It's like
there's
Friday,
no way this is a weekend.
Okay, then it's like a week.
Is it? Because
he goes to school for a few days, and then they have the party over the weekend. And I'm sure they say it in those point of view shots, but I'm just tuning out, much like Joel is, and the intention of those shots.
You know, Mike, I like that you sort of followed my footsteps, because remember in Losing It, I was in the car, the auto body shop down
That's
in
right.
Tijuana.
Well, I was trying to just act my age.
Oh, sure, I get it.
I didn't want to show up at the house party.
Who would I be? There's so many great scenes. I feel like there's a lot of opportunities to be sort of exiting a scene, satisfied with my call girl business, but I don't know if I want to do that.
Not again, anyway.
Not again. I already do that enough in real life. Why would I want to, I don't need to be in a movie for that.
You could play the mattress renter. Do you remember the part in the movie where they rent a bunch of mattresses that then go on to be used in their impromptu pop-up bordello? I didn't know that you could rent a mattress.
Oh.
Oh, my God.
I do like in the movie where, she beckons him over, and the guy just elbows him. He's like, "Get over there and fuck your girl in my store! What are you doing?" Okay, here's what I would do. I would add a scene, and I am a cashier at a grocery store, and Tom Cruise comes up and just buys 100 frozen dinners, and I'm like, "What are you doing, kid?"
Nice. I thought you were gonna go with the classic trying to buy condoms, but was too embarrassed.
Oh no, I think everybody's barebacking in this movie. I don't think there's any safe sex.
No. I think the girls are bringing them. I don't think they're.
I don't know. I don't think so.
Mike, in Losing It, they didn't really care about the boys had to bring their own condoms. Losing It, it was fair game. I mean,
well, it's kind of funny how in Losing It, Tom Cruise would not have sex with a prostitute, and in this one, it's all he does.
He can't stop. Just call her a girlfriend, and, we're fine.
Girlfriend experience?
Ooh.
Is this an early version of that?
Ooh, Riley Keough, my heart. Okay, so it's time for the award section of the show. Best and the worst of Risky Business, maybe the Golden Oakleys. Mike, do we have another name? What is he singing? I guess it's just a candlestick, right? That he's singing into for the old-time rock and roll. That's, that's not great, but...
I mean...
I'm going to say right ahead, Risky Business, best film. Nominated, best film.
Okay.
Do we want to nominate this for... What do you guys think about best role?
I think that this is probably, at least at this point, one of his best performances. I think that you can see a lot of what you see on the screen here, I think absolutely comes in play down the line. I think he's kind of refining what it is to be a star, and I think he's working with a director who truly understands who he is, and I think that this is definitely one of the iconic performances. When he receives a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Academy or the Church of Scientology, this will be one of the early things in his role,
I do want to call out, I do agree with all that. I think that this is a role worthy of, nominating, and we can always remove it later, Mike, if it's overshadowed, but... The scene that I just watched was when they have the plan, they go to Mr. Renstick at the mattresses and everything, but when they're at Lana and Vicky's apartment, there's the egg before he brings it home, and the egg is sitting next to an open window on the windowsill.
Yeah, well, I mean, why don't you just put that egg away before...
Yeah.
Man. And all the car keys, I'm just rookie.
We have a category, best fight. I don't know if there's really like a fight in this movie. I mean, he sort of runs away from Guido a lot, but I don't know if there's really a fight.
No.
So I do want to add best car scene, or best chase or whatever, because we do have the running from the cops, Marines, and Mexicans and losing it. So
oh, that was a crazy scene where he just opened fires in the middle of town and everyone scatters.
Escaping from Guido and Risky Business. Nominated this for sure for best theme song / soundtrack / score.
Oh, yeah.
Best dance scene, of course. Old-time rock and roll.
Yeah.
This is an interesting one. Best cruise outfit wardrobe.
Well,
glasses and cigarette?
Well, yes, but...
Underwear and buttoned-up t-shirt?
Well, I was going to ask, do you have a best sunglasses category? Because this is a man who has innovated so many fashion styles and sunglasses.
We do now.
Wayfarers, right? Then you get the Ray-Bans, as you mentioned.
Do you have a category for best stunt?
We do have best stunt. We're gonna get there. Yes, absolutely.
I wanted to ask you about that. Was that him standing on the dock when it went down? It looked
I don't
like
know.
One of his first early stunts or something.
There wasn't anything in the trivia, but it seems like, I mean, knowing that he does everything in the Mission Impossible movies, like probably. So the one trivia thing I saw on IMDb was that the sales of the Wayfarers, these glasses that he was wearing, were real low when this movie came out, and sales went up by 2,000% because people were like, I want to look like that. Like, it feels like, you know, Mike, when we play on the Joe 2 podcast and we do the Google game, like the autocomplete, where we'll say, like, you know, Ryan Gosling, The Ides of March, and then what does it look like? And it's always, as Joe has pointed out, people who want their boyfriend to look like Ryan Gosling and guys who want to look like Ryan Gosling. So it's like hair, sunglasses, workout, shirt. And so I think here, you know, Tom Cruise sunglasses would probably be like an autocomplete for a bunch of movies. So
yeah,
absolutely.
He must have increased, you know, the sales at Sunglasses Hut. Sunglass Hut, I think it sold like 30 times.
Trips to the mall way up. Is there a line or a freak out in this movie that we want to nominate?
I mean, he freaks out. I feel like he freaks out. Like, I feel like he's kind of freaking out the whole movie. And definitely when he's late and he's threatening the nurse. Like, that's the main freak out, I feel.
I'll say threatens a nurse in Risky Business. That's cool. I mean, not cool, but, you know, it's cool. I do like the, as just a line, not a freak out, I do like the final line of the movie, I think. My name is Joel Goodson. I deal in human fulfillment. I grossed over $8,000 in one night. Time of your life, huh, kid? And, like, that's kind of icky and gross, but also, like, that's this movie, you know? So
I like when he stands up and he says, looks like Illinois State. Like, that's kind of funny, but that's not really the line.
Yeah.
I think the line is, you got to say fuck it or whatever that was.
What the fuck, yeah. Most athletic feat, do we want to say?
Catching the egg?
Catching the egg is pretty great.
Or sex in that chair, because I'm telling you, like, someone's going to get hurt.
I do want to write down, I want to write down best sex scene. That's definitely for sure. Around the house with Rebecca De Mornay.
Hey, nominate sex on the train, you coward.
On the train, in parentheses, you coward, says Walt.
Around the house with Rebecca De Mornay sounds like a fix it up it show. Fix
oh,
show
I would watch it. But best athletic scene, so catching the egg in Risky Business, or at the end of Risky Business. Best love story, worst love story, eh. It's not really a love story.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think we're going to get, like, real ones down the line.
And my last question, unless there's another category that we have not invented yet, but do we want to nominate anyone, specifically maybe Rebecca De Mornay, for best or worst non-cruise actor role performance? Do you think, because so far already in the female category, we have Diane Lane as Sherry Valance in The Outsiders, shout out High School Slumber Party, and we have Shelley Long as Kathy in Losing It.
I think she's better than Shelley Long.
Okay.
I mean, let's put her in, because, like, I was actually really kind of struck by how nuanced she was playing this. Like, I couldn't, you know what I'm saying? Like, times I really believed her, other times I couldn't believe her, and, you know, really, it was hard to get a read on her, and I think that's good acting. Like, I think that was very interesting of her as a character to be like, what is she, what are her true intentions? And I really couldn't, you know,
she is mercurial.
Question, have you ever thought about, like, splitting the categories up into best love interest and then, like, best non-romantic female lead?
What we learned by doing the Charlize Theron podcast, which I am thrilled to say that you and Michael will be on the Flarsky episode. I'm going to call it Flarsky, even though it's called, you know, long shot. It is Flarsky. What we learned from Watch a Throne is that because of the inherent sexism of Hollywood, when she is the star of a movie, there's generally not another woman in the movie. It's just like, that's our quota. We got the one. There we go. So in that kind of situation, we couldn't really break it into different kind of categories because we were just sort of grasping at straws to fill out a category of just like five strong women.
Yeah, we cut down like on half of our categories, I think, by the end of that run as well. So like we really tried to stretch and explore like new interesting categories and things that would be fun to track and stuff, but it got a little tedious and then, yeah, hard to sort of fill an entire like four or five like examples.
Because I do think that that's something worth noting, but I feel like if we do that, best romantic partner or whatever, the other category kind of won't exist.
All right, my nominee for best non-Cruise role is Jerry Tullos. He played Derelict on Train, and he's America's Sweetheart.
I mean, not since Bum on a Park Bench in Back to the Future Part 1 has there been a more memorable movie transient that comes to mind.
The final question, and I think the answer is yes, briefly. Does Tom Cruise run in this movie? The only time I noticed it was when the car starts rolling down the hill, he runs after to see if he can catch it, stop it, whatever. Not a lot of running in this movie, but a little bit, briefly.
I caught that little sort of like kickstart before he started running over the furniture to catch the egg.
Mm.
I'm not sure if that counts enough.
Yeah, a little bit. He doesn't have a mile and a half run like he does in Fallout.
No full stride. Yeah.
But I mean, again, no movie really does that. But I cannot wait to get to those Mission Impossible movies. But we have so much good stuff between now and then, including the next episode. We have All the Right Moves, which Mr. Brian Rodriguez will be back for.
I'll be back.
And then he is gone from this podcast forever. Thank God.
You don't know that.
I know. I'm kidding. We love having you around, of course, Brian. And Walt, you will be back in a little bit for Volunteers on Hank's. Yes. And then again for Big. Oh, we talked about Big, but you'll be back on Big. And you'll be on a couple other movies coming up later, so.
Yeah, I'm so thrilled to come back, you guys. This is always a ton of fun. It always takes me to places that I hadn't been before, and it's always a real pleasure to come on. So I'm really looking forward to coming back.
Well, thank you so much for both of you for joining us. And next week, our Tom Hanks episode, if you want to listen ahead, get ahead, is three episodes of the show Family Ties, which are all on CBS All Access. So if you still haven't burned your 7-day trial to watch Star Trek Voyager or Discovery or whatever Star Trek show is on there, apologies to all Star Trek fans out there. 7-day free trial, CBS All Access, 2 episodes in season 1, 1 episode in season 2. Go check out Family Ties, Tom Hanks. Walt, please plug Numlock News and whatever else you want to. This comes out after the Oscars, so nobody... Are you going to have a... I'm sure you will, but I guess the question is when. A post-mortem on the Oscars?
Yeah, so we did the Oscars predictions, and that you can find at awards.substack.com. That's a nice little pop-up newsletter that I do with Michael Domenico from Not Her Again. But my main work is at... I'm insider senior editor for Data, and my primary like personal business is I have this newsletter called Numlock News, and it's a daily morning news brief full of numbers in the news, and you can find that at either Numlock, like the key on the keyboard, numlock.substack.com, or just at numlock.news. That'll navigate you there, or it's in my Twitter bio, which is at Walt Hickey. But yeah, no, if you want any of the awards, actually the awards coverage is in the past, but yeah, so I'm also on Michael Domenico's podcast, Not Her Again, so you can catch that there. I think he's going to be on the podcast coming up soon, actually, right?
He will. He will be on Far and Away Cruise Club coming up in about 3 months, 3 or 4 months.
Cruise and Kidman.
Cruise and Kidman, yep. Go get the Numlock News newsletter for free, and then, you know, if you pay for it, $5 a month, just give Walt a couple, you know, let him buy a cup of coffee every once in a while. And then sometimes you'll get an email says, hey, gift some subscriptions to your friends. And I gifted all three of mine away, and now I got an email for more. So I'm paying it forward with mathy newsletters. And again, not to keep blowing smoke up your newsletter ass, but what I like about your newsletter is that most of it's free. Like the paying for it, you get the long form Sunday thing, but like, the daily stuff and everything is free, and the award stuff is free. So, like, there's a lot of stuff you just give away. So why not, you know, pay an artist for his art and, you know, read about the sagas of MoviePass, which now just got delisted. So that's, you know, very important. Brian, why don't you plug High School Slumber Party? Because Fridays are for fun, after all.
Yep, Fridays are for fun. After you listen to this show, listen to High School Slumber Party. Obviously, we just talk about high school films. We have a good time. I ask people what sleeping bag that they'll bring on. Mike, you've been on a bunch of times. Joe, you've been on a bunch of times.
Oh, yeah.
Would love to have you on, Walt. That would be very cool.
Oh, man, Brian, I would love to come on to your podcast. This sounds like a ton of fun. I would really enjoy doing that.
Oh, sweet. Awesome. High School Slumber Party. What, you said it's coming out next Friday?
Yeah, so last week was your We Need to Talk Talk About Kevin episode. So yes, what is dark. What comes out today?
Today is The Perfect Score.
Oh.
And our guest is Erica Smith. She was on our Saved episode.
Oh, from Bust Magazine.
Yeah, oh, no longer at Bust, though.
Oh, formerly of Bust Magazine.
She's at Refinery 29.
Yeah, so. Cool. Very, very cool. And, you know, I do want to say eventually, if you want to, if you can't get enough of people stealing tests, I think at some point you'll probably do this, but Bad Genius, which I think is a Thai thriller, high school thriller, is a great cheating the SATs movie. So check that out,
and
too.
And then, Brian, if you want to keep in the genius sort of titles, Real Geniuses with Val Kilmer, I'd always be on that episode.
And then if you want more Val Kilmer, come back for Top Gun. And Top Gun 2? Was he die? I don't remember. We'll get to it. Ooh. On Cruise Club. So for all things Cruise Club and Hanks for the Memories and High School Slumber Party and all 24 of our shows on the network, you can go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, run@cageclub.me. Oh, we have a Patreon. Check out our Patreon, patreon.com/cageclub, if you want to control what we watch and just say hi over there. I try to post stuff over there that I don't post anywhere else, so just go check out that community. I found out today, Mike, that we have someone watching our Patreon but not contributing, so I guess they're following the blog essentially but not pay. I don't know. Whatever you want to do, patreon.com/cageclub. Come back in next week for Family Ties on Hanks for the Memories, and come back in 2 weeks in this feed for All the Right Moves. Oh, I need to guess. We need to guess. Mike, have you seen All the Right Moves?
I have not. I have not.
I don't remember how we do this. Are we guessing Family Ties, or are we guessing All the Right Moves? What do we do?
I don't know. This is all
it's new.
And we're doing the double.
I think what we should do is guess the next one for the show that we're on.
So the next cruise.
Yes.
We didn't guess on the last Hanks. Oh, no, you did. Yes, you did. You guessed this on Hanks.
So okay, we well, I think we should change Hanks it up, though, cruise. I think.
Okay.
So let's guess. So we're just not going to guess Family Ties, because that's a TV show. It doesn't really matter. So, okay. Sorry, Brian. So All the Right Moves.
I have a theory, but okay.
I'm guessing right is going to be a precursor to Step Up, where Tom Cruise goes to a school. He's a bad kid and has to be taught to love through the art of dance.
Okay, I think it's more of like a Charlie Bartlett kind of thing where he like runs the school and is like almost like, what was that, like Hitch, you know, where like he's got all the answers but it's like a teen version of that. I think it's like that.
Wow. Okay.
And maybe he finds true love and like needs to sort of stop playing himself so hard and like settle down.
Okay.
I feel like Teen Hitch would kind of work, right? That could totally work. Like, that's like a Netflix movie just waiting to happen.
Teen Hitch would absolutely work. I feel like Teen Hitch probably already exists in movies that we're just not thinking about, but Matchmakers? Brian, are there matchmaking high school movies? I'm sure.
Of course.
Teen Hitch? Teen Witch?
I was going to say it rhymes with Teen Witch, so that's cool.
We'll come back next week for Family Ties. Come back in 2 weeks for All the Right Moves, which is maybe about what we said, maybe not. Who knows? run@cageclub.me. Send us a note. Just say hi. Win a prize pack if you email us, so that's not a joke. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Walt Hickey of Numlock News and Brian Rodriguez of the High School Slumber Party Podcast. And we'll see you in 2 weeks right here on Cruise Club. Just stay